From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, syndicated cartoonist Aaron Magruder. His strip, The Boondocks, is about two brothers, Huey and Riley, who have moved with their grandfather from an inner-city neighborhood to a largely white suburb. The strip has been controversial for its take on everyone from P. Diddy to President Bush. Also, we Google Google and meet the founders of the search engine, Larry Page and Sergey Brin. And we remember psychologist Shirley Glass, who researched and wrote about infidelity. She died last week at the age of 67. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown. U.S. military officials in Iraq say they've captured a major figure in the militant Muslim group Ansar el-Aslam. They describe him as either the number two or number three person in the organization and say that he may have contact with Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda terrorist group. A car bomb exploded outside the Turkish embassy in Baghdad today. It's the third car bombing in the Iraqi capital in less than a week. The suicide bomber died and at least 10 others were seriously hurt. NPR's Jackie Leiden reports from Baghdad.
The Turkish ambassador condemned the attack, which bore the characteristics of other recent big bombs here. Witnesses described an American Chevrolet pickup loaded with explosives detonating just outside the embassy. The Turkish ambassador to Baghdad said three people inside the compound were hurt, and on the street, Iraqis lay bleeding and injured. The driver of a truck which collided with the suicide bombers was among those critically hurt. The cab of the truck was soaked with blood. The Turkish ambassador and American officials, as well as Iraqi citizens, all point to foreign influence in the recent bombing spate. "It's Osama bin Laden's people," said one young man at the scene. "They want to disgrace us." Jackie Leiden, NPR News, Baghdad.
The Supreme Court has agreed to decide whether it's unconstitutional for public school students to pledge allegiance to one nation under God. The suit in question comes from California parent Michael Newdow. The Reverend Barry Lynn, executive director of Americans United for the Separation of Church and State, says the pledge with the wording "under God" is used inappropriately in schools.
The Pledge of Allegiance was written in 1892 by a Baptist minister, but it had no reference to God. The reference to God was added in 1954, and I think Congress made a mistake in doing it, and certainly school children should not be required to participate, even silently, in what has become a religious ritual.
Jim Henderson, senior counsel for the American Center for Law and Justice, says the argument that reciting the pledge with the words "under God" violates the Establishment Clause in the Constitution is not valid.
Our position on the Establishment Clause is that it was designed to prevent establishments of churches officially by the federal government. The phrase "under God" doesn't belong to any particular religion. It doesn't result in any particular church being favored over any other, and it simply does not violate the clause.
A federal appeals court ruled last year that the reference to God in the pledge as recited by school children is unconstitutional. On Wall Street today, the Dow Industrials finished up 48 points at 98.13 in active trading of over 1.2 billion shares. Advancers beat losers 18-13. The Nasdaq closed up 9 points at 19.43. The S&P 500 was up nearly 4 points at 10.49. This is NPR News. A group of four universities has filed more lawsuits in a growing battle between two college athletic conferences. John Dankowski of member station WNPR reports.
Connecticut, Pittsburgh, Rutgers, and West Virginia claim that the Atlantic Coast Conference conspired to destroy the Big East and take its most prominent football programs. The latest lawsuit is aimed at Boston College, the third Big East team to announce that it's leaving to go to the ACC. Miami and Virginia Tech had already accepted offers. The suit also names BC's athletic director, Gene DeFilippo, who served as chairman of the Big East Athletic Directors Committee while negotiating a deal for his school to leave the conference. ACC officials are now being sued individually. A judge had thrown out an earlier case against the conference on jurisdictional grounds. The University of Miami is already a defendant in a separate case. Millions of dollars in television revenues are at stake. The ACC wants to expand to 12 teams to stage a lucrative league championship game. For NPR News, I'm John Dankowski in Hartford.
Australian writer D.B.C. Pierre has won the Booker Prize, Britain's most prestigious literary award. Pierre, whose real name is Peter Warren Finlay, won for his debut novel, Vernon Godlittle. It's a fictionalized account of the aftermath of a Texas high school massacre. He was cited for reflecting the world's interest in modern American life. Pierre will receive around $83,000. The Booker Prize is open to writers from Britain, Ireland, and the British Commonwealth. Hundreds of thousands of Los Angeles area residents have had to seek alternate transportation today due to a transit strike. The mechanics union walked out at midnight. Drivers and other LA transit workers are honoring the picket lines. At issue is contributions to the mechanics union's medical fund. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Novo Nordisk, working to improve diabetes treatment in the U.S. For 80 years, diabetes care has been our passion, not just our business.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Aaron McGruder, writes and draws the syndicated comic strip The Boondocks. This year, Rolling Stone described him as one of the five young political cartoonists bringing the noise of dissent to America. The Boondocks has been controversial in some newspapers because McGruder takes on issues pertaining to race, politics, and pop culture. The strip is carried daily in 350 newspapers. McGruder is now working on a TV series and a movie based on his Boondocks characters, and he has a new collection of his strips called A Right to be Hostile. The Boondocks is about two brothers who have moved with their grandfather from an inner-city neighborhood to a largely white suburb. The older brother, Huey Freeman, named after the Black Panther Huey P. Newton, is something of a political and social critic, even though he's still a preteener. His younger brother, Riley, wants to have the thug look, like the rappers and action heroes he emulates, but he worries he might be too cute to look tough. McGruder is critical of pop culture's focus on the thug life. He thinks African-American pop culture, rap in particular, has gotten stuck and has stopped evolving.
When gangster rap started, there was more balance, you know, in the early 90s, very late 80s, early 90s, when it first came out and got popular. There was a bunch of different type of hip-hop music that was out, and it's not that, you know, gangster rap in and of itself is this horrible thing. It's just when you're inundated with it, and kids are inundated with it nonstop, and there's really not a lot of alternatives that are presented to them, it becomes slightly problematic. You know, not just for the idea of content and what it's saying, as much as just the idea that, you know, we have really become, we black people have sort of lost our creativity, which, you know, we're kind of known for and we basically pride ourselves for. That's basically gone away. And that to me is a greater concern than just the content issues and the violence and the misogyny and all that stuff.
Well, this is a theme that you kind of cover a lot in Boondocks. I mean, in one strip, a character says, in the past 10 years, we've seen the near total disintegration of black political and social leadership. That means the single largest influence on black America's self-image is popular culture, music, TV, and films. To ensure the ongoing mental enslavement of the black man, black TV and films must remain racially degrading, intellectually insulting, and creatively stagnant. Now, of course, that's the kind of conspiracy version of what you're saying.
Right. I'm not sure if there's, you know, three or four guys in a room planning all this out. But nevertheless, I think, you know, we're doing pretty bad right now. And, you know, it does bother me because it is true that there really is no social or political leadership in this. So all of this stuff, even though it's just entertainment, does take on a greater importance, particularly in black communities. You know, white, a lot of white people are into hip-hop, but they don't actually see themselves on the screen. They are living sort of vicarious black male hero fantasies, and they grow up and they go to college and they get jobs and they grow out of it. But I'm much more concerned about young black kids who really see this as, well, that's me, and this is what, you know, my life plan holds, to be a thug and to, you know, to do all the silly stuff they see on videos, which is just, you know, basically not true, which is the other problem with gangster rap, which is its one sort of redeeming argument was that it's telling some kind of true tale from the streets. And it's just basically not true in most cases. Most of these rappers aren't living these lives. Many of them have never lived those lives. And if they had, they're certainly not living them now as musicians. So, you know, it doesn't even really have that to stand on. That, you know, in the early 90s, you know, it was at least, I think, slightly different.
Let's get back to the Boondocks. The two main characters, the brothers Huey and Riley, have moved to the suburbs with their grandfather. And why did you have the two boys being brought up by their grandfather?
The boys are brought up by their grandfather because I felt if they were brought up by their parents would be a little too hands-on. And having, you know, the grandfather whose attitude is, you know, well, now that I've gotten you into a nice neighborhood, I basically, you know, you have nothing to worry about and I can just watch television all day. It was meant to sort of allow the boys to sort of have to, you know, encounter the neighborhood on their own. With not as much sort of parental supervision or oversight than they would have if their parents were actually there.
I want to ask you about the first strip that's featured in your new collection of the Boondocks.
Well, it was the first strip that ran.
Oh, it was the very first strip that ran. Okay, so
yeah.
It's the two brothers. They've just moved to the suburb, and the older brother Huey is saying to the younger kid, "Well, you know, we're not on the hard streets of the Chicago South Side anymore." And the younger kid, Riley, the kind of kid who wants to really be a thug, he's saying, yeah, and that means I'm the hardest, baddest thing for miles, and I can run amok here without fear. So, you know, to the young kid, it's just an opportunity to, like, look tough and to assume that the other kids in the neighborhood are going to think he's tough. What are some of the things that you were drawing on in thinking about that strip?
You know, the strip you're talking about is the idea that you know, there's a certain lack of understanding here with first of all, Huey and Riley being so different often fail to communicate effectively even when they're talking to each other. But you know, in particular, Riley is looking at the new neighborhood from a sort of gangster mentality, which means, oh, everyone here is soft, and it's an opportunity for me to sort of, you know, come in and take over the place. You know, most of gangster rap culture comes from Scorsese movies, or you know, Scarface, Godfather, or in Casino, Goodfellas. And so there's this sort of, you know, larger than life attitude, as though, you know, these people are any of these people could do something like that, or be Scarface, or be Robert De Niro in Goodfellas in real life, which, of course, they can't. It's part of what the critique of gangster rap is about, which is, you know, you're not Cuban, you're not Colombian. You're black and you live, you know, in a poor neighborhood and you sell drugs on the corner. You're not a mob boss. You're not a Don. And you know, most of you probably have never even sold drugs on the corner. But it's a fantasy that was created by white America. And white America did such a wonderful job romanticizing the mob that they then turn around and be surprised when young black America emulates that. You know, we watch the same movies everyone else does, and we like the same actors as everyone else does, and we like the same directors as everyone else does. Only, you know, so many of us live harder lives that the idea of the sort of dashing criminal is much more appealing to try to act out in real life than it would be to white America that has many other opportunities.
I know what you're saying about that. On the other hand, like before the Scorsese movies, there were movies like Superfly that, you know, also had that real like gangster image and a lot of like guns and drugs and.
But there was a difference.
Money. Yeah.
There. Well, yes. I mean, the blaxploitation era is. I think we see elements of that. I mean, but there was a difference, which is, you know, the blaxploitation era had heroes. I mean, Shaft was a good guy. Mm-hmm. Coffee Brown, you know, the Pam Grier movies.
Right.
Yeah, there were bad guys and there were good guys. And there was also a very sort of a political sort of pro-black, you know, slant to a lot of it as well. I mean, yeah, there were a lot of pimps and there was Dolemite. And but even someone like Dolemite was in a lot of ways a sort of hero. You know, it was all about, you know, giving it to the man, so to speak. And, you know, while certainly we see the influence of blaxploitation in hip-hop today, it is not the same as The Godfather or Scarface, particularly Scarface.
Now, you say in the introduction for your new collection that if it wasn't for September 11th, the strip would have probably ended in 2002. Why?
Because I was just burnt out. I'm not a performer. I'm never there when people read the strip. To me, it's a very small thing. I do it. I send it to my editor, and then that's it. I'm on to the next week. There's no immediate gratification. It's not like standing on stage and telling jokes and seeing the audience respond to it. Also, it's an incredibly difficult job, which was sort of starting to wear on my health, and I just wasn't really happy. I mean, it's just brutal, and many cartoonists work for years before they're syndicated and have time to sort of, find out if this is what they really want to do. And I sort of did 30 strips in college and then went straight into international syndication, and it was a heavy adjustment those first couple of years. And I think what changed with September 11th was it felt as though the strip would actually have a purpose, have sort of a reason to exist beyond just sort of telling jokes about Puffy and BET and all that stuff. And also it was material. There was something to talk about now. There was something that was going to allow me to write the strip for 6 months without a tremendous amount of effort. And, the fact that I think, so many people responded so positively to what I did after September 11th made it seem worthwhile to continue doing it.
What was your most controversial strip in the period just after September 11th?
It's tough to say because, for 6 weeks it was banned in New York. There was the one where Huey calls the terrorism tip line to turn in Ronald Reagan for funding Osama bin Laden in the 80s. And that one, I guess, started what would be 6 weeks of the strip being banned in New York. So I kind of look at that one as the most controversial. But I don't know. I mean, I did a lot of stuff for about a year after that a lot of people just didn't like. I mean, there was one strip where Huey was making reference to the German official who compared Bush to Hitler, and made note that Hitler was actually democratically elected, unlike Bush. There was a bunch of stuff. I mean, I was having a good time and just trying to say things that I realized needed to be said, but that nobody else was going to say.
Did you think at all maybe you should tone things down a little bit out of respect to New Yorkers who lost so many friends and family?
These people died because the federal government, amongst other things, was asleep at the wheel. I don't see how it's at all respectful to allow the government off the hook for its responsibility in what happened on September 11th. And that's what's so scary about this country. We feel as though, for some reason, at the most critical moments in history, that we should sort of give up our right to speak freely and say what we feel. And it's a very scary thing. I think about the Iraq War and how when it started and everyone thought it was going to be over quickly, we paraded the dead around all day on television like they were these great heroes. And we couldn't, it just went on and everyone got shot in the finger, got on television. Now we've got at least, an average of 10 soldiers being wounded a day and one or two being killed a day. We don't see them. Because now it's gotten ugly, and now that's considered a buzzkill. Like, hey, you're bringing us down. You're focusing on the negative. Like, these soldiers' lives are somehow less important, or their sacrifice is less important than the ones that got wounded or died early in the war. It's sick. It's just really perverted.
The older brother in the Boondocks, Huey, is named after Huey P. Newton of the Black Panther Party.
Mm-hmm.
When you were growing up, did you wish that you had a kind of galvanizing political cause to be part of?
Well, look, there is a galvanizing political cause. It's just no one's galvanized. I mean, it's not as though black people in this country have it good or there aren't enough causes to fight. It's just no one's fighting them. I don't, romanticize struggle. Struggle is what it is. I'm not going to sit back like a lot of people and wish I was a member of the Black Panthers. Black Panthers were murdered and exiled and killed in jail. That's not cool. We had a lot of struggle where black people died young, and that's why we didn't win those struggles. There's no point anymore in going to jail for a cause because it doesn't mean what it used to mean. There are no cameras there. No one's going to remember. There's just, you know, that is what I look at as a sort of outdated mode of fighting. What I want to see is, I want to see people fight, but I want to see people fight in a way that's going to bring about a victory.
My guest Aaron Magruder writes and draws the syndicated cartoon strip The Boondocks. His new collection of strips is called A Right to Be Hostile. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest Aaron Magruder is the creator of the syndicated cartoon strip The Boondocks. He has a new book of Boondocks strips called A Right to Be Hostile.
There's a strip in which I forget which character it is, but I think it's one of the brothers' friends is watching Fat Albert for the first time based on the Bill Cosby character.
Mm-hmm.
And he's really disappointed. I mean, he doesn't like it. And he doesn't see what all the fuss is about. And I guess I'm wondering if you had that reaction when you were growing up to any of the pop culture that your parents or relatives, older relatives, really loved, but it just wasn't working for you.
You know, not really. I think the Fat Albert strips were, to me, just really sort of going back and looking hard at that show, because so much of the stuff that we love from the 70s, my generation, we love it out of nostalgia's sake, whether it's Good Times or Fat Albert or, you know, whatever. And, you know, it's hard to shake nostalgia, but you go back and look at it and you go, wow, a lot of this stuff was incredibly offensive. What's particularly interesting about the Fat Albert thing is that it's Bill Cosby. And Bill certainly likes to take a holier-than-thou stance, particularly with regard to what young black kids are doing today. And again, it's not like there's not room for legitimate criticism, because I criticize what young black kids are doing today all the time. But it's just really interesting to go back and look at what he did back in the day, which, if it were, you know, seen today for the first time, I think would be incredibly offensive to the sensibilities of average black people.
What do you think would be offensive?
Well, look, it's Fat Albert, Dumb Donald, Weird Harold, Mushmouth. I mean, there was the interesting thing on the Emmys where, you know, Wanda Sykes asked him about the difference between, what he used to do and what black comedians are doing today. And Cosby said very coldly, well, we used to speak English. And I thought, well, gee, you know, not really. I mean, if you look at Mushmouth, I mean, look, when people make fun of how black people talk, they're doing Mushmouth. For the most part, they're not cute kids. They're not particularly smart kids, as indicated with Dumb Donald. They don't speak particularly well, like Mushmouth. They're grossly overweight. It ain't exactly the most uplifting show.
Do you have a favorite TV series from when you were growing up and had a lot of time to watch TV?
That's a good question. I there was a bunch of shows I liked. I used to love the Peanut specials. I think that more than anything, it's really why I'm doing what I'm doing. And those, the Halloween special and the Christmas special, those were just great. TV shows, man. We did watch Good Times, and we watched What's Happening, and you know, we watched the black shows, and you know, we liked them. We also watched, gosh, that's an. I'm trying to think back to what the heck I was watching when I was a kid. you know, it's funny when you're older. Shows that seem like they were on forever really weren't on for very long. I remember. It seemed like Battlestar Galactica was on for like half my childhood. It was a show that we really loved, me and my brother. But it was on for like a season and a half, maybe like two seasons at most. You know, we watched Transformers and, you know, some of the cartoons that were on. A little old, when we were a little older, obviously, like everybody else, the Cosby Show was a big, big deal. And Family Ties and Cheers and... And then later, you had Married with Children, which I thought was a really, really good show.
You know, some of like hip hop culture is about like having your posse, you know, having like your people who you can like travel with and be with and so on. The work you do is so solitary, sitting alone at home and drawing a strip.
Yes, I have no posse.
I have no posse, right?
I have no people.
But does solitary work suit you?
Yes and no. The isolation of being a cartoonist, I think, is a problem even to those cartoonists who are not into hip hop. It's just a very, very lonely job. Nothing in Hollywood is as difficult, in my opinion, as being a cartoonist. It's all this stuff is easy after that.
Why is being a cartoonist harder?
Because it's completely on you, and it never ends. It's like I think it's Sisyphus, I believe, was the guy that has to sort of push the boulder up the hill and then mm-hmm. it keeps rolling down.
Mm-hmm.
I may have screwed up the name, but the point is, it's that sort of never ending burden, and you work incredibly hard to get something done, and then you get it done, and then you got to do it all over again, and it never ends. It's a very, very difficult job, and most of us do it all by ourselves, which makes it more difficult. It's, at the end of the day, it's much easier to yell at somebody else for screwing up than to be angry at yourself for screwing up. It's just physically much more damaging when the burden is all on you and you're beating yourself up week after week.
So when you're feeling kind of dry, what do you do to get ideas?
Panic. Uh-huh. I mean, there's no easy answer. I mean, again, it's part of why the job is so difficult. When you're doing it alone and you everything has to come from you and it's not there, there's nothing to do but panic as the clock ticks and the deadline approaches.
Now, you have a deal to turn the characters in Boondocks into both a TV serial and a movie. So what's your role in the TV series and the movie?
I'm an executive producer, meaning that, on the creative side, I'm the boss now. Doesn't mean much to the network or the studio, but at least with the writers and the artists, I'm the boss. And I'm writing the pilot now, and I'll be, I think doing a lot of writing on the series. I'm just basically the guy in charge, and, it's a very different thing.
Right. Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Aaron Magruder writes and draws the syndicated comic strip The Boondocks. His new book is called A Right to Be Hostile, The Boondocks Treasury. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Books, publishers of Dow Osmond's The Stones of Summer, inspiration for the film Stone Reader, available at Barnes & Noble bookstores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the University of Alabama School of Law, shaping the next generation, on the web at alabamalawschool.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
So what does the word Google really mean? Coming up, we meet the founders of the search engine, Larry Page and Sergey Brin, and we remember psychologist Shirley Glass. She wrote about infidelity. She died last week at the age of 67. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We have Googled any number of persons, places, and issues, but to find out more about Google itself, we invited the creators of the search engine to talk with us. Larry Page and Sergey Brin celebrated Google's fifth anniversary last month. Google is one of the most popular internet search engines, and the numbers are kind of astounding. Google receives more than 200 million search queries a day and has an index of over 3 billion web pages. If you've never done a Google computer search, here's how it works. You type in the name or keywords that you're researching, then hit a key, and in about a second, you get a listing in descending order of importance of the relevant websites. Brin and Page started Google as a research project when they were graduate students at Stanford University. When you started Google, was it just like the two of you in your office or rooms together?
When we started the company, it was pretty quickly three of us, and it was my dorm room was the office, and Larry's dorm room was the data center. He had all these computers piled up in there. Yeah, I don't think his roommate found it entertaining after the first day or so, but because they're loud and they have lots of fans and stuff. Then pretty soon we rented a garage and a couple of bedrooms from a friend of mine. So we sort of had half of her house. And we spent, the early days kind of in a garage like a traditional startup.
And how many employees do you have now?
We have about 1,000 employees now. Kind of all around the world.
And why do you need employees around the world?
I wonder that myself. But because when we started this company, I was always baffled by all these big corporations and how what did all those people do? But it turns out that there are many important things to do, and our employees do a wonderful job. We have many engineers who continue to innovate the technology, deploy new products, and improve old ones. We have many salespeople, which help us generate revenue. We have a lot of people who talk to our customers. Then we have a lot of employees who help take care of the other employees in various ways. So, by the time you sort of add up all the corporate functions, you add up with a lot of people. But I think when you think about it, as to what impact do those 1,000 people have on the world, it's actually an amazing amount of effect per person, because we're sort of we're serving the world its information, and arguably you should be willing to devote many, many more people to doing that.
Now, do people angle for better placement? Everybody wants to be that first item that comes up in a Google search.
Absolutely, people try to get better placement within Google. And part of our job is to give you, the absolute best information, the most objective and honest information that we know how. And we work very, very hard to do that. And it is a little bit of a battle for us.
But I would also like to clarify, it depends on what you're searching for. If you're searching for particle accelerator, findings and statistics or something like that, there's probably not going to be too many people who angled sort of for positioning for that. If you're looking for something like casinos online, for that, there'll be lots of kind of people who use many different mechanisms, some kind of nefarious, some not, to try to get to the top of the search results. And at a basic level, we try to make our algorithms resilient to those kinds of things, and try to make them mathematically sound. There's always a gap. There are always situations under which a person is able to get somewhat ahead via various techniques, but we're continuously making changes.
The searches and the results in Google are done basically by computers, not by people. You don't have people deciding what the ranking is. It's these mathematical formulas that you've computerized. So that means what? That you have computers that every time you type in something in a Google search, the computer basically searches the whole internet to tell you what the right web pages are?
Let me explain how that works. There are basically three stages to web search. The first stage is called crawling, and there are a bunch of computers, thousands of them, that go out and surf the web basically, much like you do, only much, much faster. They do it at thousands of pages per second. And in the process, they download all the web pages. Then there's something called indexing, where we take all those web pages and we build the equivalent of what's at the back of an encyclopedia for all those web pages, only it's quite a bit more detailed and quite a bit thicker. It's probably almost as big as the encyclopedia itself. And finally, once you have that index, this is when people's searches actually come in, then you reference things in the index and you try to decide what the best results are for any particular query.
How many searches does Google do a day?
We do hundreds of millions, more than 200. And so that's, if you work that out, that's thousands per second. So it's pretty amazing to think about that as your, you know, going into your library and, you know, asking the librarians questions, only having thousands of questions asked per second.
Also in many, many different languages, over 90 languages all around the world.
Explain what Google means and how you came up with the name.
Well, Google actually spelled slightly differently. We had a little bit of trouble with spelling. I've never been very good at spelling. But G-O-O-G-O-L means a very large number, one followed by 100 zeros. And basically we were looking around at large numbers and thought that it would be fun to use something really large because we wanted to index, you know, all the information in the world, and happened upon Google and thought it sounded cool. And we were able to get the domain name, which even at the time, 1998 or so, was quite a difficult thing.
When you started working on Google, before you actually became a company, how did you get the word out that this new search engine existed?
Well, I think that's the amazing thing about the internet, is that it is a very efficient method of distribution, and Google is even part of that. But we told a few of our friends and our professors and actually a few people at a conference, and more people just started using it, and they told their friends and so on. And it grew virally, really by itself. And I think for something as important as search, where Sergey just mentioned, you know, you do it all the time. You search for all sorts of things very often. You want to tell your friends when you find, you know, this great new service that works better for you.
And at what point did you decide this should be a business?
I think at some point the search kept growing, and we had more and more users come in every day. And we were kept running out of compute power. We didn't really have enough computers. We had sort of a handful. And in fact, we'd go down to the loading dock in the computer science building, sort of borrow the ones that were sitting there before, you know, the people who had really gotten them on their grants, like, got around to it. Eventually that became kind of unscalable. And we decided we could get better resources if we started a company. Though it was about, you know, a 3-year path till we came to that decision. And finally, we decided that we could, so we went out and we bought a whole bunch of disks on our credit cards, and then we were committed. And so after that, we raised the money and started a proper company, and here we are today.
My guests are Larry Page and Sergey Brin, the founders of Google. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests Larry Page and Sergey Brin are the founders of the internet search engine Google. Google is used around the world, but are there some countries in which the government can screen the results, screen and censor the results of a Google search?
There are to a certain extent, like the United States, for example, but only in a very limited way. So we do comply with
local
laws.
Where did you say the United States?
Yeah. Yeah, in the United States, so for example, the United States has the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. And so there's a mechanism by which sort of copyright holders can object to what they view as copyright violations being listed. And so as a result of that, there are, but there are probably like, you know, a handful of sites or, you know, I don't know, maybe 100 web pages that are blocked for that reason. And what we do in that situation is there's a message at the bottom of your search results that says there are, you know, omitted results for this reason because there was this DMCA complaint and so forth. And then there's a site that you can click to, and it will explain the issues in that particular complaint and so forth. In other countries, like in France and Germany, there are some rules against Nazi sites. And so there's, once again, a very small number, a handful of sites that are blocked. There are other countries that have sort of entire filtering technologies on the internet as a whole, as in sort of all the access points to the internet for a country are proxied, and at those points the country can block certain sites. Probably the most famous case for us, we were for a period of a number of days blocked from China. But for the most part, in most countries, you know, you see 99.999% of what's in there.
You were completely blocked in China?
You know, it's always murky because you can't really tell. Mm-hmm. But we were largely blocked. We could tell that for, I think, on the order of 10 days. And I think there was a lot of sort of popular protest because it is a very useful tool for doing all kinds of things, you know, whether it's scientific development, education, business. And so eventually we were unblocked.
We should say that Google is, we want to provide information to people. That's what we do. And so we try to err on that side whenever we can. And I think this will be a very interesting issue for the world going forward.
Now, anyone who's used Google knows that when you type in the word, the keyword that you're looking for, the keywords, that you can either click on the Google search or the I'm feeling lucky search. What is the I'm feeling lucky option?
Well, unfortunately, I created that option, and people like it, so we haven't been able to eliminate it yet. But the idea was when we created Google that it was going to be so accurate that you didn't actually need to look at the search results. You could just look at the first result directly. And that obviously didn't quite work. So you had to feel pretty lucky in order to think that that was going to work. And so, you know, it gives you the first search result without showing you the 10 results. And, you know, for some things like if you enter Stanford University, you know, it will work. You can hit I'm feeling lucky and you'll go right to the homepage.
Why would somebody choose that over just the full search?
Well, if you're particularly confident, then it saves you a step of clicking, which is kind of nice. For other people, it's kind of a fun thing to do. But you wouldn't normally use it.
How often do you Google yourself?
You know, actually, I have we have this news alert service now where you can sign up to get emails on any topic you want. And I have one running for myself.
Oh, and, how are you doing?
You know, every day I get a few things, and so which is pretty interesting to me, though I don't always have time to read all of them. But so it's sort of automatically Googling me all the time.
Oh, my name is probably a little bit more unique, so I can so it's in fact an easier query, and I don't tend to get spurious matches because my last name is Bryn, whereas Larry is Page, which, as you can imagine, occurs on the web many times.
So, do you Google yourself a lot?
I usually search for myself when I'm trying out a new search technology. Like if we've implemented a new ranking algorithm, then I'll try it because I'm familiar with the results.
Now, I'll tell you, in preparing for this, I decided, let me Google Google. So I typed in Google into the Google search, and I came up with a lot of Google things in the regular search. But in the Are You Feeling Lucky search, I got nothing.
Well, you just get Google itself.
Yeah, it got Google itself. Oh, I see. Google was giving me itself.
Yeah.
Oh.
In computer science, we call that recursion.
Oh, you even have a name for it. I didn't quite get that. I kept thinking, oh, it's just repeating itself. I didn't realize it was giving me itself. And what's the name for it?
Recursion. It's kind of, Sergey's giving me a dirty look.
Why?
It's a loose definition.
Sergey.
It's a loose interpretation of the word recursion.
Sergey, what's the more literal interpretation?
The technical term is you got itself back.
Right?
Yeah, I don't know. There's not really much beyond that.
Okay.
Idempotence. How about that?
Say it again?
Idempotence.
What is that?
That's when you... maybe I should stop while I'm ahead.
You're just making this up, aren't you?
Before I dig a deeper hole. Idempotence is when you do something and you get the original thing back.
Oh, so that's a real word?
It's a mathematical term.
Yeah. But it's also just as loose as an interpretation as Larry's was of recursion.
Do you guys ever feel like the stars of Revenge of the Nerds or something? Because obviously, like, you know what I mean? Like, you live in this world of, like, algorithms and arcane language and words and mathematical things that a lot of people who aren't in that world like to just think of nerd, you know? And, like, now you have this, like, incredibly successful creation and business, and I'm sure you're really hot stuff and everything. You know what I'm saying.
Well, I'd hope we can serve as a positive example for people of kind of the power of science and technology.
Mm-hmm.
And, for me, I guess my dad was a computer science professor, and I grew up with computers sort of from age 6, which was unusual at that time. I just felt really lucky to have access to all that. And
yeah.
I guess I had sort of an innate feeling that there was a lot you could do with these things, and it would really change the world and be important. And I'm always amazed that there aren't more people who work on technology and science and ways of changing the world in that way, because I think that's the easiest way to change the world.
I want to thank you both so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. A pleasure being here.
Larry Page and Sergey Brin are the founders of Google. Coming up, we remember psychologist Shirley Glass, who wrote about the nature of infidelity. This is Fresh Air. We were sad to learn that psychologist Shirley Glass died last week of breast cancer at the age of 67. She was a marriage therapist who had devoted much of her career to studying and writing about the nature of infidelity. She was also the mother of our colleague Ira Glass, the host and producer of This American Life. We spoke with Shirley Glass last winter after the publication of her book Not Just Friends, which was about what she described as the new infidelity. The news she delivered was that good people in good marriages were having affairs, and that today's affairs are more frequent and more serious than they used to be because more men are getting emotionally involved and more women are getting sexually involved. Many affairs start in the workplace, but it's not the old stereotypical relationship of the boss and secretary.
What I see happening in the contemporary workplace is that men and women are working together as equals. They are colleagues because women have entered what were formerly male-dominated professions. And so these men and women get to know each other very well. They have a lot of respect for each other. And they're working in an environment where there's a lot of excitement, there's a lot of pressure. And so they become very bonded and they form deep friendships. Unfortunately, because they many people think that they're invulnerable to having an affair unless they're in an unhappy marriage. They begin to imperceptibly cross these thresholds that lead them from a platonic relationship into an emotional affair. And then that emotional affair often becomes sexualized, and then you have something that's very threatening to the primary relationship.
Now, you're right that there's a new kind of affair in which there isn't necessarily even any sex. You call this like the new infidelity, affairs that aren't even sexual. Well, how can that really be an affair?
Well, I think the epitome of that is the internet affair. And when we say that there isn't any sex, what we really mean is there isn't any physical contact. But there is a lot of sexual tension and sexual chemistry or sexual sharing of fantasies or sharing of sexual attraction. So that this emotional affair that doesn't have physical contact consists of an emotional intimacy that is often greater than in the committed relationship. And once that relationship becomes secret, then you have something that is much different than a platonic relationship, because platonic relationships are open to the committed relationship. So, for example, somebody will come home from work or from school or from the gym, and they'll be talking about some new person that they've met, and they'll share lots of information about this person and the fact that they went to lunch together, and they talked about the schools that they went to or whatever their common interests are. And then it's as though this person disappeared from the face of the earth because they stopped talking about them and they stopped mentioning that they saw this person today or that they had lunch with this person or they stopped after work and had a drink with this person. And once that wall of secrecy goes up, that is a very important danger sign that you've entered a very unsafe zone for your a committed relationship.
Okay, so you've established that a lot of infidelity starts at the office, where two people are working together, they're very involved with each other, and that develops into an emotional and then into a physical relationship. Are there certain types of people who are most likely to get involved in this kind of affair at work or with a friend?
That's a very good question, because what I see is that these are not the typical philanderers. These are not people who believe that it's okay to have a little bit of sex on the side. And these are not people who are consciously looking for a relationship outside of their marriage because they're so unhappy. And so these are pretty average people in good marriages. Perhaps the marriages are stressed. Perhaps they don't have a lot of time to do fun things together. But you certainly wouldn't call these marriages distressed or unhappy. And so I don't think that there's a particular type. I think that people who are aware of the dangers and who back off when they feel those attractions and see those signals are certainly much less likely to get involved this way.
If you find out your spouse has been having an affair, you'd probably want to hear all about it and obsessively dwell on the details, and at the same time, you wouldn't want to hear a word of it. So what advice do you usually give couples about how much information to share about what actually went on in the affair?
I'm really guided by the betrayed spouse. When somebody finds out that somebody that they have loved, somebody that they have trusted, somebody that they thought was a good person has lied and deceived them, then their reaction is traumatic. And they experience the same post-traumatic reactions that people experience when they are violated by someone that they trusted, when a natural disaster happens, when a person who thought that they were healthy finds out that they have a serious illness, because they lose their sense of innocence and they lose their sense of invulnerability. And one of the things that we do when we're traumatized is we try to make sense of it and we try to understand what the story is. And so telling the story of the affair is the only way that I know that people can get closure, and it's the only way that I know that people can rebuild trust. In terms of what questions need to be answered, usually the betrayed partner has pages and pages of questions, And then as a therapist, then I have certain questions that I want people to think about, because I think that they deal more with the meaning of the affair than just the what, where, when, and how.
What kinds of questions would you ask that deal with the meaning of the affair?
I would ask, how did you give yourself permission as you cross these various thresholds? I'm looking for, what are the vulnerabilities? Was it curiosity? Was it flattery, as you pointed out before? Was it that you felt your emotional needs weren't being met in the marriage? Is it because everybody that you work with is engaged in these kinds of relationship and it looks like it's an acceptable thing to do? So we want to know, what are the different vulnerabilities that set the stage for an affair? I want to know, what role did you play in that affair, in that, with that other person? That, what did you like about yourself in that other relationship? And what would you like to bring back into your marriage? What did you give in that other relationship that perhaps you aren't giving in your marriage? And if you were giving more in your marriage, maybe you'd be more invested. And maybe this marriage would seem more appealing to you, because the more we invest in a relationship, the more we feel. And so sometimes the affair looks better because the person is making time for it. They get together, they look in each other's eyes, they plan when they're going to be together, they share their most recent triumphs and their disappointments. And if we did that in our marriages, the marriages would feel a lot better. So I'm trying to get at, what's the meaning of the affair, what was the attraction of the affair, and what does it say about the marriage, so that we can use that information to build the marriage back.
Shirley Glass recorded last February after the publication of her book, Not Just Friends. She died of breast cancer last week at the age of 67. We send our condolences to our colleague Ira Glass and his family. Fresh Air's executive producer is Jenny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Calico Corners, your home for custom decorating, with over 100 stores across the country, on the web at calicocorners.com, and from Rodale Incorporated, publishers of Not Fade Away, A Short Life Well Lived by Lawrence Shames and Peter Barton. The book tells the story of Barton's maverick life and unique response to dying young, at bookstores everywhere. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with journalist Elizabeth Rubin about post-war Iraq and her experiences reporting from war zones around the world. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.